Ephesians chapter 2, we'll start there. If you were in our Bible class this morning, we were studying discipline. If you look at the newsletter, there's an article regarding discipline. I think you'll find it helpful as well going along with what we talked about this morning. For our lesson, let's talk about helping one another effectively overcome our sins. We often talk about the church as the family of God, the house of God, and well, we should. Look there in Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19. Notice the description that's given. Now, therefore, you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God. That's incredible. You're no longer foreigners. You're no longer strangers. You are fellow citizens with the other saints. You are part of that great household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ Himself being the chief cornerstone. If you're going to build something, that's a good way to start. It will be right. It will be perfect in every way. And that's what you're part of. That's the family you belong to. Just continuing through it, in whom the whole building, being fitted together, grows into a holy temple into the Lord. Are we a temple? Not just any old building. There's lots of buildings. There's banks and all these things. But what are we to be? We'll be a building of praise and honor, glorifying our Lord. In whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God in the Spirit. He is to be in us. Special bond and closeness that grows within this family as God's people. Galatians 6, we're to bear one another's burdens, so fulfill the law of Christ. Romans tells us we're to rejoice with those who rejoice, we're to weep with those who weep. We have all of these different things that we partake of with each other, and as this happens, we grow closer. That closeness should be building. And with that closeness comes trust. Would you give your brethren the key to your house or the key to your car and never think twice about it? Because you know they take care of it better than you. I would definitely give the keys to my truck to other people because I know they would take care of it better than I do. If you've ever seen it, you know it doesn't take much. But we don't worry about these things. We trust these people as we trust family. The more we work on that bond, the closer we'll get as a congregation. But that's not what I want to talk about this morning. What happens when that does occur? When we do get close enough to the point where we're willing to open up to one another. We're willing to seek each other's help. Because that's what we want. And when it starts happening, what then? Because there may be this knee-jerk reaction where we're not quite ready for that. We're not quite ready for the openness that can sometimes come. This is what God wants. James 5:16, confess your trespasses to one another. Pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. We talked about that earlier as well. Thinking about the prayers of a righteous man. And you don't have to turn there, but in Acts chapter 8, verse 24, you've got Simon the sorcerer. He has become a Christian. He's been baptized into Christ. He desperately wants, when he sees the apostles and their abilities, he wants to buy that for himself. But Peter just lays it on him and says, what you're doing is corrupt. You have no part or portion in this. And you remember Simon's response is basically, Peter, what have I done? Pray for me. Pray for me. And so he's willing to go to his brother there and seek his help. This is wonderful. But it might catch us by surprise if we're not ready for it. When my brother comes to me and is willing to pour his heart out, am I ready for that? Because I may be shocked by what he has to say. What if he comes to me and I think, this guy? This guy struggles with profanity, alcohol, pornography, greed, you fill in the blank. This guy? No way. We may be amazed that somebody that we see as an absolute rock has spiritual struggles. We might be. We shouldn't be. Did Moses qualify as a man of faith? Would you consider him a rock? I mean, you know, and I've made the joke, if I had to have my starting five basketball team of faith from the Old Testament, does Moses make the team? Yeah, he's there. Did he struggle? Well, let's talk about his faithfulness at first. Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 5 describes him as Moses, the servant of the Lord. I hope my wife and my girls can put that inscription on my tombstone. Not the Moses part, obviously, but the rest of it. I hope they could honestly say that. Don't you? This is his life. This is not a shot at Auburn fans, obviously. I went to a funeral one time. The whole thing talked about Auburn. Guy was a huge Auburn fan, loved Auburn football, and everybody dressed in Auburn colors and things like that. I sat there the whole time and thought, how sad. How sad. He lived 65 years. And this is the commentary on his life. The football team he liked. Man, what a missed opportunity. I would hope that my family could say that about me. That the summary of my life was service to the Lord. But we're talking about Moses, so let's get back to that. It is said 5 verses later, since then there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face. Again, I'll ask, was he faithful? Was he a rock? Absolutely. He struggled too. Numbers 20, he was supposed to speak to the rock, and yet he doesn't. He lashes out, he strikes it. He ends up missing, entering into Canaan because of that. He struggled. What about Peter? You think Peter ever struggled? First of all, would you call him a rock? Jesus changed his name to Peter, which means piece of rock. Is he a rock? Acts chapter 2, the day of Pentecost. Man, how would you like to be a fly on the wall and just see that taking place? Peter is the one whose lesson we're given there, boldly standing up and proclaiming the gospel for the first time. Was he a rock? Yeah, he was. Then a few chapters later, when the Sanhedrin say, "You stop it. Don't do it anymore," Peter says, "I can't help it. I got to do what I got to do." We serve God first, guys. We always will. Is he a rock? And yet this is the same guy who denied Jesus and would later play the hypocrite against Gentile brethren. Did he struggle? These are good men that we've mentioned this morning. They were faithful, but they struggled too. I shouldn't be surprised when my brethren have struggles. Even brethren that I consider to be a goal. I want to be like them. I appreciate it. I love their faith. But they struggle too. It shouldn't shock me. Satan is very good at what he does. It may be that our brother or sister's particular struggle is not much of an issue for us. There are things that you and I are just not very susceptible to. There are temptations that just don't affect you at all. You know what they are. There are some... Satan's not going to use alcohol against me. He's not. I'm not remotely moved by that in any way. Will he use it against some of my brethren? They are very, very weak against that. But here's the thing. Things that I'm strong against like that, I'm weak in other areas that my brethren are strong in. He's not going to waste that on me. But what about fear of failure? What about worry and stress? Does that work? Oh yeah. Yeah, that works. And so what my weaknesses and yours, they aren't the same, but we both have them and we can both use each other to help get through them. You better believe Satan knows what your weaknesses are. He's seen us fall for them before, hasn't he? He's a spiritual being. He's got a very long memory. He remembers what's worked against me in the past. Just to bring up some more Old Testament examples, he knew what worked on David. I won't make you turn there, but 2 Samuel 3, it's mentioned there, all of the different wives that David had and all of the different children that they bore to him. 2 chapters later, it says when he gets to Jerusalem, he takes more wives and more concubines. Do you think that lust may have had an influence on this guy? If you don't, just go a few chapters later and consult that whole business with Bathsheba. Do you think Satan knew what worked against him? Of course he did. Do you think Satan knew that Cain had some anger issues? Of course he knew. He knows you. And he knows me. He knows what works against us. So here's the thing. When brethren come to us, it takes some guts, by the way, some courage to admit your struggles with a brother or sister, even if you trust them, even if you love them dearly. That's hard. Let's say somebody's gotten to the point where they're willing to come to you or me and admit their struggles. Here's what they don't need. They don't need me to be They don't need me to be condescending toward their problem. They don't need me to look at them and say, I can't believe you struggle with that. Whoa. That's not helpful. They don't need me to tell them how much I'm shocked by that. They just open their hearts up to me because they want to fix it. And they're looking for help desperately. The last thing they need is a condescending attitude. By the way, that's not loving at all. That's not being considerate of them at all. Something else they don't need is dismissiveness. Where they come to me with a problem, I basically say, oh, that's nothing. Just quit. Whatever you're doing, just quit. Don't I think they've probably tried that? Because now they're coming and seeking help. So what does that say? They have acknowledged the fact that, look, I am struggling. I can't do this by myself. I need some help. The last thing they need for me is to look at it like, that's nothing. I don't have any trouble with that. What they? They're not me. Right? We talked earlier, some have weaknesses that others don't. They are struggling with it. They don't need this. They need someone that can help them through it. They saw us as trustworthy, somebody they could depend on. Do we dismiss them or belittle them for it? And one other one, they don't need a lecture. They really don't. Because if they know that something is sin and they came to me to help them get out of sin, they don't need me to tell them that it's sin. They've already figured that one out. So we can say, when someone comes to us, we can say, whoa, hey, let's go to 1 Corinthians. See, we don't need, they know. What they need is for me to help them get past it. My goal should be helping them strengthen themselves. You can turn to Ephesians 6 if you'd like. You remember verses 10 through 18 there, you've got the believer's armor. Love that section. Love the chapter. Love the comparison that's given there. We're given a description of what that armor is like. It's good. It's powerful. It gets us through this life. Did you know, as you're reading through that, you see the different pieces there. We're told to put on the whole armor, so you need all of the individual pieces. Did you know that in the past, warriors sometimes needed help putting their armor on? Did you know, if you're familiar with history, there was a time period before cannons and gunpowder and that stuff really came into the battlefield. Knights on horseback ruled the day. And I'll give you a little bit of an indication if you're not much familiar. That stuff was heavy, and it was thick, and it was strong. And when knights on horseback came running toward you, it was probably over. They ruled the battlefield. But you know what? Those guys couldn't get on the horse without help. It was strong. It is mighty. Without a squire, he ain't getting it on to begin with. He needed help. And this is my point. Turn to Ecclesiastes 4. Let's do a look at this first. Do we see God never expected us to have to try and do it all by ourselves? Ephesians chapter 4, verse 9. Two are better than one because they have a good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him. And a threefold cord is not quickly broken. Let me give you a picture representation of this. We need each other. We can help equip each other, right? We've been given a description of the believer's armor. That's good. Which would you rather be? Roman soldier, typical armor. Would you rather be this guy, standing there alone with his one shield? Or would you rather be in this? I will tell you very quickly where I would like to be. Easy. I want to be 1, 2, 3, 4. This guy. Right there. I have shields to my left, shields to my right, shields over me, and guys standing behind me. I will be that guy. Right? Because the thought of arrows piercing my skin does not interest me in the least. The thought of Satan's fiery darts is even worse. Right? So here's the thing. Why just use my one shield? We can be a wall together. The Roman army understood this principle. The Greeks understood it. The Vikings understood it. Why Why do we have such a hard time with this concept? We are better together when somebody's watching your back and your sides and your front. We're better together. It's a simple matter of warfare and strategy. It's a simple matter of being a faithful Christian too. When we come to that understanding, things will be easier for us. We can help each other more. What happens, though, to miss it? I mean, that's easy to see, right? What happens? Stubbornness happens. And pride happens. Don't let pride keep us from seeking help. If we're the one who's struggling and we need help, pride will mess all of this plan up. It makes sense when you look at it. Pride will just split it and tear it to pieces. Turn to Psalm 78. Here's the hope for Israel, starting in verse 7, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep His commandments. Verse 8 is what I want us to look at, though. And may not be like their fathers, a stubborn and rebellious generation, a generation that did not set its heart aright and whose spirit was not faithful to God. Don't be like your fathers. Stubborn and hard-headed and hard-hearted. There are a lot of other verses that deal with this. Isaiah 46, 12. Listen to me, you stubborn-hearted who are far from righteousness. How would you like that as a form of address? Jeremiah 6, they're all stubborn rebels, walking as slanderers. They're like bronze and iron. They're all corruptors. Ezekiel 2, verse 4, they are impudent and stubborn children. I'm sending you to them, and you shall say to them, thus says the Lord God, because they're hard-headed. I wonder how many of us this applies to. Just being honest. Here's a question for you. You know this verse, Romans 3, verse 23. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Does all include you there or not? If you're old enough to know right from wrong, here's a hint. It does. It includes you. We have all sinned and fallen short of God's glory. So, doesn't matter who you are, you and I are weak against sin sometimes. Pretending that we're not struggling with it when we really are is just foolish. And ignoring help is foolish. Here's Proverbs 14, verse 3. In the mouth of a fool is a rod of pride, and the lips of the wise will preserve them. Pride and foolishness are old running buddies. They go hand in hand. And when they get together, you know what you get? A whole lot of stupid. That's what pride and foolishness do together. They get together, and that's what they produce over and over and over again. My brethren love me and want me to go to heaven. I should feel the same way about them. If I do, won't I let them help me? And won't I be interested in helping them? If I really do love them, and we want each other to go to heaven, we'll do this. So, we talked about what not to do. Don't be condescending. Don't be dismissive. Don't give a lecture about something they already know the answer to. What do we do? Turn to James chapter 1. Let's look at some things that we can do and should do. James 1. Verse 19. The first thing we need to do is listen. So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. Actually listen when they talk. This is not nodding your head along with them as they're talking until they stop to take a breath so you can jump in and hijack the conversation from them. That is not listening. Just be quiet and listen to what they have to say. If they've come to you with a problem, it says a lot about how they feel about you. They trust you. They are about to open their heart up to you. Be quiet and let them do it. Because the thing is, they're probably not asking for a 10-page dissertation from me on how this is not a problem for me. They may simply need to talk through it. And once they start talking with somebody who's supporting them, they may figure it all out for themselves. They may be able to work their way through it because they just took a burden off their shoulders and you took part of it for them. It's a whole lot easier to run when you've got less weight on you, right? Now you're helping them. They may be able to think clearly in a way they haven't been able to before. Let them talk. And if they want you to give them advice, fine. But let them work their way through it. Another thing. We talked about James 5, verse 16. Pray for one another. Pray for them. Really? Really pray for them? Have you ever told somebody you'd pray for them and then you forgot about it? Yeah, me too. When our brethren call on us, it must become our priority. Write it down if you have to. I am so scattered sometimes. Poor Sasha. That blessed thing has to put up with that mess. I'm all over the place, 100 miles an hour in every direction. I need to write stuff down sometimes. That's okay. Whatever you need to do, make sure you do it. Don't forget. It's too important to forget this. Do you pray for them? Not just once. Not just one and done. Do you pray for them daily when they ask for this from you? Do you pray for them more than once each day? Because here's what happens. You get God involved, which is the most important part. But also, I have yet to ever be praying for somebody and not get closer to them. Not feel closer to them. I've never been praying for somebody and say, you know, I can't stand this guy now. I've been praying for him for 3 weeks. What? I just, oh, honey, we're like, no, it doesn't work that way. We do get closer. So it brings God into the mix. And now our relationship's getting stronger as well. Here's another thing. We listen. We truly pray for them. Do hold them accountable. God expects this. Turn to Proverbs chapter 27. Proverbs 27. Proverbs 27. We'll look at verse 9. Proverbs 27, verse 9. Ointment and perfume delight the heart, and the sweetness of a man's friend gives delight by hearty counsel. I'd also go up to verse 6. Faithful are the wounds of a friend, but the kisses of an enemy are deceitful. When you have somebody who really loves you, sometimes they tell you things you don't want to hear. But they do it because they want you to go to heaven. They do it because they are your friend. Your enemies will tell you whatever you want to hear. They will make it seem just so smooth and easy. Your friends are the ones who will call you on it. Paul held Peter accountable, and Peter loved him for it. Our beloved brother Paul. Things we can do along this line. Offer encouraging verses when you're reading in your Bible and you find a verse that may help your brother or sister with the problem they're going through. Call them. Text them. Say, I was thinking about you this morning when I was reading. I found this. Just wanted to share it with you. That lets them know you didn't just forget to pray for them. You are thinking about them constantly. You're on their mind. What does that do for their relationship with you? It gets closer. It gets stronger. They know you're taking this seriously. It helps them to take it seriously as well. They also know you're going to ask them about it. If they have admitted their struggles with you, and you are calling them and talking to them and giving them encouragement, they know you're going to ask them about it. Which helps keep us accountable to ourselves. This is good on every level. Turn to Acts chapter 2. Another thing that we can do is help them focus on godly things with godly people. The reason I have you in Acts chapter 2 is the early church understood this. They were together all the time. I appreciate the getting together for various reasons that we have now. I appreciate the elders doing that. I remember Matt Reynolds bringing it up in a meeting, the idea of groups and meeting. You know, the first thought that goes through your head is, I don't know if it's going to work. When people's hearts are right, stuff works. Look at what they did. Acts chapter 2, verse 42. These are people, verse 41 tells us those who believed, they gladly received His word, they were baptized. Now, verse 42, what did they start doing, these baptized believers? They continued steadfastly in the apostles' doctrine and fellowship, the breaking of bread, and in prayers. Verse 42, I have out beside it spiritual things. Right? What did they do together? Spiritual things together. But they don't stop there. Keep reading. Drop down to verse 44. Now all who believed were together, had all things in common, sold their possessions. As those had need, they took care of them. Verse 46. So continuing daily with one accord in the temple, breaking bread from house to house, they ate their food with gladness and simplicity of heart, praising God and having favor with all the people. Of course, the Lord adds to the church. They did physical stuff too. They were together all the time. Acts chapter 20, we often use it to show the Lord's Supper being taken on the first day of the week. And that's good. I want you to see something else in Acts chapter 20. Paul is there at Troas. We know in verse 7, and this is a verse we often key on, is they gathered together for the purpose of breaking bread. That's true. He preaches after that. That's true. Absolutely. They're doing these spiritual things together. But notice what happens after that too. Verse 11. When he had come up, had broken bread and eaten, and talked for a long while, even till daybreak, he departed. After the spiritual things were over, they remained together. And they did other stuff too. They talked. They spent time together. They shared meals together. All of these things are so important. And we may say, okay, saints are supposed to be close. I understand that. And being together should be normal for us. But I don't mix well with others. Practice makes perfect. Doesn't it? How do you get better at stuff? How do you get better at anything? You do it. You practice it. It's too important to ignore. So we might as well get good at being together. Right? And it is such a benefit on so many different levels. Let's look at one last thing that we do need to do for each other. Don't just talk about it. Help them come up with a plan. Help them develop a plan of action to take care of their sin. Whatever struggle, whatever temptation they're going through, our goal for our brother or sister is to overcome this thing. It's not to just make them feel better about themselves and say, well, I appreciate you coming to me, and you just going to struggle with that always, and I hate it, but no! We're trying to help them get rid of it. That's the goal. It's going to take a plan. It always does. It won't just happen automatically. It very likely will involve them making some major changes in their lives that are triggers for this sin. Right? Something's got to go. We see that in Matthew 5, verses 29 and 30. The Christian, for the guy who struggles with pornography, is he going to have to make some serious changes in his life to get rid of that? Is he going to have to cancel his movie channels? Yeah, maybe so. Is he going to have to move the computer into the living room so everybody can see it? Maybe so. Is he going to have to get rid of the internet access on his phone? Yeah, he may have to. Oh man, we're talking about cutting people's heads off here. That's lifeblood stuff. Yeah, that's how serious it is. Would you get rid of that? I'm talking to the generation that can't live without a cell phone in their pocket. Would you throw that thing away if it meant your soul? That's how serious it has to be taken. They need a plan of action. Now, obviously, that's not the only sin. There are others. What if somebody has a bad habit of associating with bad people? What do they need? They need some good, godly friends. And you and I need to be first on that list. We need to help them and introduce them to other people. Our friends say a lot about us. Turn to 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33. You know this one. I could probably just ask you to quote it. I'd get like four different versions depending on the translation, but it all has the same idea. Do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. Evil companions corrupt good morals. We know the idea. You hang out around wickedness, it can influence you. Wicked friends, we talked about this earlier, tell us what we want to hear. Godly friends tell us what we need. You remember Amnon? Remember all that business with Amnon and Tamar? He had a friend named Jonadab. Jonadab helped him sin. David had a friend too. His name was Nathan. He pointed out his sin. Which one do you want? One of those types of friends will help us to godliness. the other one will tear us to pieces. Our friends, our closest friends, say a lot about us. Am I working to build relationships with God's people? Are my closest friends, if I'll just be honest, my closest friends in this life, are they worldly or godly? That will tell me a lot about me. It really will. This is not banning all non-Christian friends. Not at all. But I am saying, who are those that I have the closest bonds with? If across the board it's worldliness, probably need to look at some things. That's not a good sign. How much do you love the souls of the saints? All the stuff we talked about this morning can be summed up in the answer to that question. Because helping each other overcome sin is going to take time and effort. It's not a 5-minute fix. It's not one of those things where we can just jump in and be done. This is going to take you and me being invested in one another. It's going to take a lifetime of that as well. This is God's plan. The early church understood it. We need to understand it. So, for those struggling with sin, you have friends here. They're not going to judge you. They're not going to look down upon you because they've done it too. They've been in sin too and struggled with it. And they may be right now. They may need your help. You have friends here. It's always interesting to me what they are going to do. And it's how Satan works. And it's pride. It's pride too. I'm not going to say anything because I don't want them to look down on me. Man, if their hearts are right, they will do everything they can to help you. That's what they want more than anything. It is interesting. There's an area called the Wilderness of Sin. It was between Elam and Sinai. And it always struck me as funny. It's described as the Wilderness of Sin. And I got to thinking, that's right, isn't it? Sin is a deserted area. There's no life there. Nothing grows there. Nothing good. And if I get caught up there, what happens to me? I will wander around in that wilderness until I die. Physically and spiritually. But it doesn't have to be that way because people are looking for me. God, first and foremost, wants me to come out of that wilderness of sin. But my brothers and sisters do too. They may be sending out search parties. When they call, will I call back? Go ahead and get your songbooks out. If you're lost in the wilderness, come back. Jesus has given us a way back through Him. He wants us back. Our brethren want us back, but He expects us to take the first step.